My name is Klaus Weber. I'm the Deputy Director of the Northwestern Buffett Institute for Global Affairs. And I welcome you back to our webinar series, Building Sustainable Futures, Global Challenges and Possibilities. And as many of the regulars know, we consider a different United Nations Sustainable Development Goal each year that we use as a theme for the series. And for the spring quarter, we'll be looking at some SDG 10, Reduced Inequalities. Now, the spirit of this webinar series is to sort of take a step back from the SDG and sort of look at deeper dynamics, structures, histories of this. And SDG 10 is particularly interesting and timely because the COVID-19 pandemic has both illuminated, but in many cases amplified existing global inequalities and really brought them to the fore. And those are inequalities both between and within countries. So what we will do this quarter is to explore the histories that produced economic, social, health, educational, and other inequalities, and also the current infrastructures that maintain them to have an understanding of their origins and why they are so difficult to tackle. We'll also learn about steps that some people are taking to create a more equal and egalitarian future. Today's opening panel starts this conversation, and what we do, we'll look at legacies of inequalities, myths of progress, and possibilities for future justice. And we have three fantastic Northwestern faculty as panelists, so I'm going to very briefly introduce them. I'm not going to go through their very long and list of accomplishments, but the three are Katrina Kissenbeng-King, who's an assistant professor of sociology here at Northwestern. And she studies racial classification and exclusion and is particularly interested in how state actors conceive and make decisions about race and citizenship. Doug Keel is an assistant professor of history at Northwestern and a citizen of the Oneida Nation. He studies Native American history with particular interests in the Great Lakes region and 20th century indigenous nation rebuilding. Simone Ispelanta is an associate professor in Northwestern School of Education and Social Policy, and also a fellow at the Institute of Policy Research here. Her scholarship concerns the sociology of education, race, and gender, and she's particularly looked at school discipline, punishment, and stigma in that setting. So what a fantastic group of scholars to have. We'll hear different angles, different perspectives, but what they all share in common is taking this deeper look at inequalities beyond the surface measurements that we see and really try to understand where they come from, how they're being produced, and why they're so sticky and why they're so vexing as a problem for us. So I believe Katrina will take us off. So I'll hand it over to you. And you can start with your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Klaus. I'm just going to share my screen here, so bear with me. Okay. So thank you again, Klaus, for the introduction, and to Ariel, Ahmed, and Dylan for organizing. And I think Klaus said it sort of in thinking about the kind of important questions that we've been confronting as a society recently. I think the wider public in the United States has been thinking a lot about racial equity and justice. And so I'm happy to enter into this conversation with and think about these questions with my colleagues, Simone and Doug. So I think that most people would say that they care about inclusion, equity, and reducing inequality and sustainability. And as we think about what it means to reduce inequality, two questions come to my mind. First, where do these inequalities come from? And second, do the ways that we conceive of progress and development lead us to a more just and equitable future? Or perhaps posed more critically, are our ideas or myths of progress actually antithetical to justice? In my research on race, US empire, and citizenship, the answer to the first question, where do inequalities come from, requires a reckoning with the history of how powerful elites, politicians, and judges built a white supremacist country. And the answer to the second is that, unfortunately, yes, many times our ideas of progress do stand in direct opposition to justice and equity. Throughout US history, powerful people have used the idea of progress, I'm using air quotes here if you can't see me, to subordinate exclude or forcibly include others while putting power and resources in the hands of white people. And they have used the ideas of progress to justify violence and erasure. Here, for example, is a political cartoon from 1899. This was a month and a half before this cartoon was published, the United States acquired the island colonies from Spain. And as you can see, this scene is a classroom, and I'm sure that Simone will speak more to education and progress, but I just want to highlight the idea of civilizational progress as education that accompanies both forcible inclusion and subordination. This is a new class in civilization with Uncle Sam at the front. He's an adult charged with educating these uncivilized dark children in the front of the classroom. He says to the Philippines, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, and Cuba, these are the United States' new colonial territories, that they'll catch up to the class ahead of them, which is seated directly behind them. And this class is mostly made up of the territories taken from Mexico in 1848. Also in the classroom, you can see a Black person washing the windows, paying attention, but not included in the lesson. There is an American Indian person at the door frame, partially included, but reading an upside down book, and a Chinese person outside the door, unable to join the class or unable to enter. This cartoon speaks to US politics, race, and conquest. It raises the question of who is in charge, whose mandates, norms, and rules should be implemented. Who defines what it means to be civilized, and what is the yardstick by which we should measure progress? For the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Cuba, and Hawaii to succeed, do they need to become like Uncle Sam or the students seated behind them? And given the treatment of Black, Native, and Asian people in the United States, is this even desirable or possible? I'll just add that there's a lot of text in here, but the blackboard behind the class says that England governed her colonies without consent and greatly advanced the world's civilization. And so too will the United States. The United States will teach these colonies until they can govern themselves. So as I mentioned in the beginning, I focus on race and citizenship and empire, and I mostly focus on the Philippines. And in regard to the Philippines, which you saw seated in the front of the classroom in the previous slide, this is the United States' largest colony. And in 1898, President McKinley proclaimed that the United States was not an invader, but a friend that sought to educate and protect Filipinos. The US would expand rights for Filipinos, their quote, little brown brothers, freeing them from the despotic rule of their former colonial overlord, which was Spain. This statement became known as a benevolent assimilation proclamation, but make no mistake, the United States was an empire. It conquered the Philippines, suppressed independent struggles, and forcibly included the archipelago under US sovereignty. And the United States held onto the islands for almost 50 years until 1946. In these years, various politicians claimed that the United States was not an empire, but that it was the bearer of a constitutional democracy, that US politicians, bureaucrats, military, you can see here, missionaries and teachers, the woman in the hat holding the school books, that these people were training Filipinos in the school of civilization and government, similar to the first cartoon. According to the politicians of the time, Filipinos would grow from brown savages into nearly white men capable of self-rule. Perhaps today these cartoons seem obviously racist and out of date, but this is the history of how the United States became a global superpower. And inversely, it is the history of how the Philippines came to be thought of as underdeveloped. These cartoons remind us that the United States is an empire state, and that the United States development was contingent upon the exploitation of non-white people. These cartoons depict a long history of racial rule, and this rule continues to matter for understanding present day inequality. I don't want to suggest that nothing has changed since 1898. For example, the Philippines is no longer a formal colony of the United States, but of course the United States still holds colonies, so let us not forget that. And this matters, that the Philippines is no longer a formal colony and that the US still holds colonies. And today the Philippines is actually one of the fastest growing economies in Asia. But given that I'm a critical sociologist, I can't just leave it there. The Philippines continues to lack infrastructure, face land tenure issues, and have stark economic inequalities. In other words, inequality comes from empire, and yes, our ideas of myths of progress are actually antithetical to justice. Decolonization of the Philippines left power in the hands of landed elite and foreign investors. And the United States, even as it claimed to end an era of colonial rule, actually crippled the emerging Philippine economy, secured the US's investment, trade, and military interests in Asia, which I could talk about more. And so I'll just close this part by saying that many of the societies that we look to as so-called models of democracy and development were actually or remain empires. Their growth or development was achieved through the conquest, dispossession, and enslavement of other people. How we study development relies on normative Eurocentric assumptions of what it means to progress. Yes, the polities and economies of many of these so-called underdeveloped states are different from the United States or from Western Europe, but are we supposed to judge them on a unidimensional progressive scale that was rooted in imperial conquest? So that's where I'll leave it for now. Thanks.
Great.
I'll get started. Thanks.
Got you next. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Katrina, for the great start and providing us such a helpful framework. And I already see that there's lots of overlap. So what I want to really begin with is, you know, my work is in Native American history, and I want to begin with complicating ideas of equality in this U.S. context, right? We could deal with questions of racial equality, but also I think what's particularly concerning about the future as well is to understand differences between that and political equality in a settler state, right? One thing I begin with in my class on American Indian law and policy as an example to point out big contradictions and questions of equality. Beginning with an investigation of Native American rights, right, one could turn to a seemingly obvious source. Let's go to the Bill of Rights, right? So day one, we go to the Bill of Rights and we look at the First Amendment. We can't get past the first sentence of the First Amendment, right, about the free exercise of religion before we run into a problem of Native Americans don't actually have this same right in the U.S. system. It's not until 1978. It was in 1978 that the American Indian Religious Freedom Act is passed and begins, I should say begins, but doesn't, you know, totally resolve the questions of beginning to incorporate ideas of Native American religion into U.S. ideas of religious freedom discourse. The long story short, right, is an unwillingness to recognize the things that Native people are doing as actually being capital R religion in that context, right? So that's one important, you know, basis for, you know, thinking about an important contradiction and questions of equality, right, as they are rather complicated in a settler state. Dealing with questions of racial equality, we can take these back to the very legal premises that established the United States, the doctrine of discovery, right, which is a series of papal declarations from the 14th century forward. These are, you know, medieval Catholic Church declarations about the presumed inferiority of indigenous peoples, right? This is what gives European empires the sanctioning, right, to colonize the world and do the work that they do, the kind of stuff that, you know, that we were just hearing about. The very idea of the United States, right, is built on the doctrine of discovery. It becomes encoded into U.S. law in the form of a case that's actually grounded here in Illinois in 1823, Johnson v. McIntosh. And to make a long story short, the question is, two people have title to the same piece of land. One came directly from the Piankashaw Native people of Illinois, and the other came by way of the U.S. government, right, a licensed transaction. So which one of these transactions really holds up and is most valid? And the Supreme Court comes to the determination in 1823 in a profoundly important case that the Native people never did possess title in the first place. They can't. They're inferior. This is doctrine of discovery. The United States always had title to those lands. They were never it was never the Piankashaw's title to exchange in the first place, right? And that sets the basis, right, for U.S. property law and claims to being able to claim dominion over the lands of the United States. I should note that this This same principle is brought up again in 2005 by Ruth Bader Ginsburg as valid legal precedent in a case on United Nation v. City of Sherrill, New York. And that's a case about buying back lands, one potential solution to the problems of land loss at the end of the 19th century has been for communities that have some economic resources these days through casino gaming to buy back their lands, right? To buy back their territories. And this opens up new questions. Can this be done, right? And this is where the doctrine of discovery comes back in 2005. Again, these are medieval ideas, right? About the presumed inferiority of native people. But Ginsburg points back to the doctrine of discovery as valid basis for, again, this idea that no, title has always rested with the United States. We inherited it from Britain after the revolution. That's the idea. So thinking about equality, right? There are these questions of inequalities that characterize U.S. history from the beginning that are really about human and inhuman in so many ways. The Declaration of Independence from the very beginning as further attesting to this kind of a tricky relationship with questions of equality. The Declaration of Independence is something we can read as one of human history's greatest human rights documents, right? That outlines the core liberties that come to define American life. But at the same time, in the list of reasons why it is that colonists go to war in the revolution, it is because of the king having made alliance with the merciless Indian savages at the frontier. And so that's to say, in the very Declaration of Independence, right, the United States is establishing a vision of human rights for all, right? The United States is a progress narrative in its creation, right? Progress in the sense that this is a deliberate exercise in trying to devise what is the most free liberal government on earth, right? That is the political experiment. And so it's important to recognize that buried within that political experiment, right, that this is going to be the land where we enact this this beautiful experiment, right? The idea is that it's not a blank landscape, right? Not a blank canvas on which they can create this vision. So buried in the Declaration of Independence itself, right, are these troubling questions of how we can think about equality and progress. And I'll just leave it with a thought on progress, effectively meaning, whose progress are we talking about, right? Progress in terms of what? And that's to say, from one point of view, we could, we could think of indigenous healing, but American progress, right? As in America coming to own its relationship with indigenous people and beginning, right, gradually to write that. Northwestern, the reason we have a Center for Native American Indigenous Research, right, is to begin moving in those kinds of directions. I'll leave it at that for now.
Thanks, and I'll just pass it straight on to Simone.
Great, thank you. This is wonderful. Those were both great, and I have to say one of the best things about doing this is getting to discover people whose work I don't know. Okay, so I'm going to get into my PowerPoint that I made. Okay. Here we go. Great. So I'm a sociologist of education and race and gender, so I'm going to be talking about legacies of inequality and myths of progress in that context. Okay, here we go. When I think about myths of progress, I just want to start the idea that when I think about a myth of progress, I think the myth is that overall progress is linear in one way and somewhat inevitable. And that's an idea that I think critical race theory has been really strong in putting out. And so, when I think about the myths of progress and kind of the assumptions that go behind it, one thing I think a lot about is that you can have new mechanisms to support old structures, right? And I think when we don't see that, we can mistakenly think that we're viewing progress. So like one example of that I often think about it in the sociology of education is Carolyn Tyson has a wonderful book on tracking. And actually her argument is that tracking upholds racial structures, but in a way and segregation, right? It creates segregation within schools. And so in a way, we can think about tracking as a new mechanism for an old structure. So the American public and policymakers would be outraged if we suggested that we reintroduce racial segregation in its kind of starkest and most blatant form. But then we have these new mechanisms that support racial segregation, right? So that's the idea that you can get new mechanisms that support old structures. And this is a problem because as pessimistic as I am about many progress claims, I do think we can take action against new mechanisms. I do think policy and practice can provide powerful levers for reducing inequality. And so we need to see the mechanisms to start to work on them. So in terms of what I study race and gender in education. Right now I'm working on a project on school discipline. And so one thing I want to talk about is just to apply this concept of myths of progress and how I think it arises within this case that I work on right now. So I want to make a kind of bigger point that these myths of progress impact the data we gather and how we use it. So I'll give an example. So in many schools and districts across the country, we're seeing declines in Black-white gaps in discipline. So declines in rates of suspension and expulsion, and the disproportionality there, or office discipline referrals are another one. So we can see a lot of these declines, right? And we can say, wow, we are really making progress. We are reducing racist structures within public schooling. And that would be, in fact, the classic conclusion. And the conclusion that you would often see in a newspaper or a research article on school discipline. But what I want to emphasize actually is that we should be careful here, because we should always be alert to the fact that new mechanisms can arise to uphold racial inequality, even when we got rid of one particular practice or policy. So, and those ad hoc solutions could arise and not be captured in discipline data. So here's an example, for instance, that I've seen in some studies or in my own research. So you could have teachers who respond to the pulling away of suspension and expulsion as a possibility by just starting to ignore students of color. So like instead of harsh punishment, it's just a complete neglect, which I would argue is just as sort of dehumanizing and problematic as other, like, right? It looks different, it's a different mechanism, but it's still upholding racial inequality. So I think we can get these things. I've seen it in schools where new practices maintain and support racial structures, but people miss that and conclude that progress has been made. And that's dangerous because then we get inaction, right? And so we still have racial inequality. It looks different, but we can't get any action around it because the mechanism hasn't been identified. I'm new to my computer. Okay, at the same time, one thing that I think about a lot and that concerns me is, you know, I don't want to get into a situation with my research or with research in general where because we understand that progress is a myth and that it's not just this inevitable improvement, we don't want to kind of, I think, lose sight of the fact that we don't want to kind of get into this space where the answers are predetermined for us. So no matter what happens, we say, you know what, it looks like progress on the surface, but really it's not, right? Like that sort of like doesn't seem sufficiently empirical to me. And I think progress is possible. I think we can reduce inequality through informed action, but we need to know how would we know that progress is happening? And so one way I think about that sometimes is I think let's measure the right things in the right way at the right time. And I'll give an example. Let's say we observe in a data set or a school district observes declines in Black-white gaps in discipline, right? So the data's there. So we could just conclude that we've made significant progress because that has been a very traditional mechanism for supporting racial inequality in schools. But I would say that let's not stop there. Let's not only measure that. Now we need to take another look around and see what else might be happening now, new mechanisms that might be supporting racial inequality. And when I say that, I'm not saying that because I think teachers or administrators or anyone is evil and trying to create racial inequality. I don't think that's how it happens. But I think that we should think about, you know, just the other things that surface as ground level educators, ground level workers, you know, use their agency and their creativity to meet their needs, and how that could end up supporting racial inequality. And there could also be racism and bias at play in some of those ad hoc solutions that come up. Here we go with my new computer. Okay. And my last note really, I think, is I loved Katrina and Doug's presentations, and I think this point is pretty consistent with what they are saying, was, you know, I think some progress myths also have to do with assimilationist paradigms. And so this is when we kind of code something as progress because we see students beginning to conform to dominant white cultural norms. And so we code that as progress. And it's similar to what I was talking about before. It's kind of a way of interpreting one small observation, like one small slice of data or piece of information, and not seeing the whole picture. And I'm right now, I do code this as progress. I am seeing in one of my research studies that, you know, teachers and administrators are collaborating to actually question the criteria by which students are judged in the first place. So that to me seems like a deeper level of progress than just saying, okay, we taught this group of students to behave in a certain way. We think it's great. Like, we're reducing discipline gaps, blah, blah. So, you know, here it's really trying to look at that criteria and, you know, not just change. So we're not just getting rid of, you know, suspension and expulsion. We're actually thinking about, like, how do we even judge student behavior in the first place? So that is it. And I will get out of screen share. And I think we'll do Q&A, I believe. Let me get out of here.
Indeed we do.
Thank you.
Thank you. This a fantastic range of takes, but with a lot of very common themes. Just as the invitation to the audience, put your questions into the chats, and Ariel will relay them to us. I have a first sort of follow-up, and it strikes me that I want to sort of anchor on the idea of myth and myth of progress that I think was permeating all three of your presentations. And one thing that occurred to me is that you sort of take away the focus on the endpoint of the progress as if we could talk about equality and justice in a vacuum without looking at where we came from and what happened before, and sort of turn the other way and really look more deeply into, you know, where do we come from, and we can't detach ourselves from that history, and that makes that narrative, that myth, much more complicated. I'd like to sort of pose a question to all of you, and it's really about the so then what do we do with this? What is the notion of equality that we can work with, or that we should look at if we take that sort of intergenerational historical take, where we have to bear in mind inequalities and injustices in the past as we have this narrative of a better future of some way. So how do you look at that temporal and intergenerational aspect, and what do you do with it to retain some positive vision of equality? And you can just jump in, unmute yourself, and you can start the conversation.
I do have some thoughts, if it's okay if I
please.
One thing that it makes me think about, and I think we all sort of spoke to this, is that it's not an even playing ground. So recognizing the history means recognizing the histories of dispossession, of school segregation, of lack of resources, of denial of political sovereignty, of all these kinds of things. And so I'm just going to give a quick example of another myth that comes up frequently in my work and in my teaching, and that I see with students, which is the myth of the bootstrapping white person. And so this myth is at the heart of popular ideas of the American dream and of what it means to succeed in this country, and that if anybody works hard enough, they can make it. And it's rooted in two primary images. And one is that of immigrants, white immigrants from the early 1900s arriving in the United States. and adapting to American ways of life and building homes and families. And the second part of this image is in white middle-class families of the 1930s and 50s living in suburban homes with fathers working good jobs. Obviously there's a heteronormative element here. And that these people and these families were white, and the myth of their grit and success relies on the omission of the role of the federal government in providing opportunities for white people. So the white people were not just immigrants, they were settlers, and their land ownership relied on the dispossession of Native people, of the lands, and on incursions on Native sovereignty. The federal government promoted these projects of white settlement through the reservation system and federal land policy. They gave land away to white people. And the burgeoning white middle class of the middle 20th century grew because of opportunities like those provided by FDR under the New Deal and the GI Bill that unfortunately were mostly given to white people, and Black Americans and Mexican Americans were systematically denied occupational training and educational benefits, insurance, homeownership loans, and more, where their white counterparts gained status and resources. And so I'm telling this history because I think it's one that's very familiar to most Americans. And it points to how opportunities for economic, so the ways that we often measure inequality is by SES, right? Socioeconomic status and other sort of mobility measures. And we can have a conversation critiquing those measures, which I think Simone sort of rightly points us to. But the point is that even if you're just gonna use those measures, you have to acknowledge that there's an uneven playing ground, that people didn't get the same opportunities to make it in America as others did. And so that what that would mean to me are things like reparations.
Uh-oh, now it's getting serious. this is a really great question, and one that, you know, again, I think there's so many ways in which resolving how indigenous issues fit into these matters is really quite complicated. And it's one way this question helps us understand that, you know, the important differences between universal human rights and historically situated indigenous rights, right? That are based on particular relationships, particular agreements, treaty histories, right? And so on and so forth, versus, right, a big universalizing set of principles, right? And that's not to say that it's a bad thing, but there's a distinction between those two things, right? And there's certain ways in which, for instance, one of our most important global documents in regards to indigenous rights is the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. An important, you know, issue buried within that, right, is this is effectively a set of norms for states that they ought be following, right? But in the first place, it is a set of engagements that are already committed to the state, right? That they are already committed to upholding and simply modifying, right, the nature of how the state relates to its indigenous people, right, in a possessive kind of way, effectively a checklist, right? If you do all of these things on this list, right, and the UN Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples, then what, right? Historical colonialism and theft has been negated. What exactly does that mean, right? It opens up a lot of really tricky conversations. You know, there's a great piece called Decolonization is Not a Metaphor. For those of you who are interested in these kind of questions, I highly recommend it. And one important point that it makes is that so many conversations about what would otherwise be decolonization are really couched in what the authors refer to as settler futurity, as in it's ultimately conversation, right? So conversations about truth and reconciliation in Canada, for instance. I'll note that those conversations take place in Canada because they do not take place in the United States, at least not in large scale, right? But those kinds of conversations in so many ways are seen as projects, as extensions of effectively what our commitments to, how can we make the Canadian multicultural state a better, kinder place, right? And that is a very different set of questions and concerns about what is it to make right with the very particular and specific relationships. And in the context of the United States, this is nearly 600 of these distinct tribal relationships. And I think, you know, getting to the, what is our path forward, right, out of, we had this great example, right, of, Americans gaining all this free land, right? It's only free if it's stolen, of course. But what is, what is some sort of pathway out of this? Well, what's grounded in the treaties as well? They're complicated. I mean, they're documents of dispossession, right? They're mostly land cessions, but they also do formalize a relationship. a relationship between the United States and Indigenous nations. And it's a legally complicated and troubling one in certain ways. Its premises of Native people as being domestic dependent. And this is what I mean by political equality, that Native nations aren't really regarded and respected as full sovereigns, right? That they're within, right? And I think that's one, that's one important characteristic. There are a number of, I can get to those later, I suppose, but obstacles to, the fuller expression of sovereignty, right? And so moving toward an actual respect, right, and equality of understanding one another as nations, right? Nations making treaties to one another, treaties that are ratified by the U.S. Congress, right, and are thus the supreme law of the land, right? So these are the United States' own documents, right? They're not documents that simply belong only to Indigenous people. They're U.S. responsibilities, and in the world of federal Indian law, this is referred to as the trust responsibility and the trust relationship. One bit of optimism is that now the official person in charge of the trust relationship between the United States and Indigenous nations is a Native woman, Deb Haaland, Secretary of the Interior.
I'm happy to chime in here, but we can also
You can just react to each other, but if you don't want to follow up, that's fine too. We're getting plenty of questions in, so we're not short on it.
I was just going to say, I once had a student in office hours who was very upset because I had proposed that we try to, equalize funding, which would mean taking away money from like very wealthy suburban districts and moving it. And I had, proposed that as a potential solution to some of the problems facing public education. And the student said, that's just totally not fair. Like, you can't redistribute like that because, you're making people lose what they have, like, that's not tractable. And I just remember I had this moment where I was like sort of trying to convey my sentiment in a different way. And I said, if I had two children and one of them was born severely premature and my family did everything in the world to save that child, including spending more than on the other child, more money to get that child to a place, like, would you think that that's wrong because I'm somehow like taking the money that could go to the other child? And I sort of feel like we need to get to that place with inequality. But I, but the other thing I think is that a lot of this has to do with political power. And so getting reparations right means it means capturing political voice for people who've been marginalized and dispossessed and using that voice effectively. Because I don't think it's automatic that, well, it's obviously not automatic that marginalized groups are listened to.
Maybe as a follow on this one, I think you all three of you sort of favor a sort of political recognition and inclusion and political equality really as a path to. As a path towards a reckoning, but also maybe a way forward based on historical inequalities and injustices. There is and this comes up in the maybe a contrast between sort of the international aspect of that and the domestic one. That there's an underlying idea here of solidarity and inclusion, that we're all part of one, and hence we see the inequalities as in violation of something that we all supposedly have access to and supposedly share, which is not always that transparent in the international global sphere where those are more easily abandoned once we get beyond this high-minded idea of universal rights and that. And maybe you can talk about what it needs to have that sense of solidarity with groups that are excluded, that are treated not as equals in a political and in a recognitional way. And just to sort of throw it in, does that need a different myth? That a myth in a neutral sense, not as a sort of something we say but don't mean, but a myth for who we are and how to do this to sort of justify that.
I think there's a good book on this subject recently. Mahmoud Mandani's Neither Settler Nor Native, I think, has a really great approach on this.
And I was thinking of that too, so I'm glad
you brought it up. Okay, yeah. Well, we can invite him. But I mean, the framework of, of basically developing affinity through an understanding of being survivors of mass violence, right? I think that's a workable premise. I'll give you another example why that seems workable. I've recently joined the Illinois Holocaust and Genocide Committee, which is about doing public education throughout the state, and it's widening its work to think about a genocide in a variety of contexts, both domestic and abroad, right? And in those conversations, trying to think about how is it we possibly link together these conversations about such disparate human experiences, right? All of which we know are, acts of, past, violence and suffering, and we found that to be a useful way to find some sort of, common ground, some sort of, affinity that we could, build together, is understanding that, we're communities that have survived mass atrocity and are rebuilding, our communities as such. And I'll add one more part about thinking about solidarity. It's so crucially important because Indigenous rights won't get anywhere in the United States without solidarity, because we don't have enough influence and resources, and and so needing strong allies is absolutely crucial to that movement. But at the same time, I think it's more of anything to sort of point to areas and in the field where we could use more work. And actually there's a response piece to decolonization is not a metaphor called slavery is not a metaphor. And that's to say, one of the challenges for how Indigenous visions of decolonization can actually begin to think about not just ourselves and our own communities, right? Models of what we call resurgence and effectively rebuilding ourselves from within and not focusing on colonial perspectives, but taking care of one another and community, right, becomes a new possible model.
I'm curious, if I may call you out directly, Simone, that do you see that that there's this idyllic view of schools as sort of community institutions and organizations? So if anywhere, that's where we would maybe see that. Do we?
As in, can you go back to the first part?
Well, the first part is as in the sense of solidarity and community and sort of the idea. And it's very much a one of the American myths too, is this sort of community organizing, right? Localness and you see it there.
Yeah, and I think the myth of progress, part of that is that the solidarity or affinity becomes speaking for, and can become a kind of political capital, especially right now, right? Like in this moment, we're in a moment where, like, for instance, very well-resourced parents can kind of use the language of equity or diversity in a way that actually benefits them rather than the students they're purportedly speaking for. And so this notion of solidarity, I think in practice it can be very tricky, especially in schooling, actually. Because it has this potential to switch from listening to and speaking with to speaking for. So it gets delicate.
I really agree with that. It takes a lot of hard work, right? And concrete effort to do so otherwise, and that's to say, I've seen in a variety of contexts what otherwise could be imagined as solidarity and affinity can sometimes actually be describing the experiences of Native American people as we don't want to be that, right? We don't want to have we don't want to be that situation, right? I've heard from folks who were defending the rights of Palestinians, for instance, offer that as a we don't want to become like Native Americans, and so sometimes, right, that kind of language and discourse can go that direction. Kehalani Kalanui has written a great book about various debates about trying to understand Hawaiian sovereignty, which means really taking into account, it's complicated, colonization in the first place. What do we go back to? Do we go back to the way it was before the kingdom, and so on and so forth? And I just think there's, there's good models for, thinking about how we, can also invent new language, right?
It also kind of makes me think about Klaus's comment earlier that was kind of hitting on the fact that we all seem to be in some ways kind of thematically surfacing political power and voice when we think about reducing inequality.
I wanted to speak just to the kind of the global aspect of thinking about solidarity. And so a place where I find a lot of, I think, inspiration is in third world solidarity, so-called third world solidarities, though that's perhaps not a way that we refer to it anymore. But I think the and this is, speaks to what Doug said about sort of common, common suffering, setting Mamdani, recognizing the fact of European colonialism actually draws lots and lots of people together around the world, and I think allows to people to link their stories, right? And so, indigenous decolonial thought and postcolonial thought and subaltern thought and the Black radical tradition, all of these are related in a critique of how Western Europe has been built on the backs of Black and brown people. And so there's like kind of that intellectual approach of like, right, oh, let's recognize the fact of European colonialism. And then this is something that honestly astounds me. And so I think about this when, thinking about the attacks on the rising attacks on awareness on Asian elders, and that, like, is there just not basic compassion to not kick an older woman in the stomach? And so for me, like, solidarity comes from a place of love and so that love and that and rage can go together. The rage at dispossession, at violence, and that you can love others. And I don't know why that's such a radical idea, but that's where I think solidarity comes from, is a recognition of basic humanity and that other people have been denied that. Again, to speak to what Doug said about, the basic division in founding this country was about ideas of human and inhuman. And hopefully I would hope that people nowadays could recognize humanity in others. It's so basic, so basic.
And I think that's often the challenge, right? I mean, at some level, it is so basic and it is so crystal clear, but in other ways, it's incredibly hairy, and in the practical terms, it's incredibly difficult. And maybe I want to turn toward that second part, because as academics, we often like to talk about the very high sort of abstract things and forget about the concreteness of the action. And I think similarly in your sort of examples, I think that is very sort of pointed and very telling how it's never easy, it's never uncomplicated, and there's always a sort of second order effect of whatever you do. It's like mole whacking, right? To use that metaphor. So what are viable interventions that sort of really change things? I know you all look at different levels and different arenas, but what are things that you see as good, promising at least?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, for one thing, I'll say we still haven't identified the interventions that really, like, that we don't have enough.
Well, maybe interventions is the wrong way of thinking about it, right? But I'm just generally interested in.
Yeah, but I think, I mean, one thing I've been thinking a lot about is that a very positive way forward would actually be if I could. Kindly request a dictionary edit, I would perhaps email the editors of the Oxford English Dictionary and say, could we please remove the word buy-in? Because it's such a top-down approach. And I do see that kind of top-down approach in inequity initiatives And I see it really hampering the true progress because, you know, buy-in itself implies a top-down situation where the ground-level educators who are really having everyday interactions and, you know, are really in classrooms and disciplining kids or not disciplining kids every day are, you know, they're buying into somebody else's idea. And I think that it will, I think, you know, really having solutions that are kind of more democratic and not top down will actually do a lot for equity initiatives, because I think a lot of educators really do care about equity and want more equitable environments, but you can get all kinds of resistance when it's top down. And the resistance isn't necessarily to the kind of abstract ideas, but it can be to the kind of the insensitivity of the remedies that are being proposed. In other words, maybe a teacher feels like that doesn't solve their problems that day, you know? So I do think we need to kind of move towards different models of achieving equity that are, and I have the same critique of DEI work, right? Like diversity, equity, inclusion is now an industry. And we all know how resentful people are at kind of being lectured and told a lot of things. So I do think we can make more progress if we have more sort of more participatory structures and vehicles for solving some of these problems.
I think the other part of that, and this is actually what brought me into sociology as an undergraduate. I took a sociology class on gender and society, and we read Patricia Hill Collins' Black Feminist Thought, and that's the work that I like cite as giving me, as like speaking to the way that I saw the world. It gave me a language to talk about the way I thought and felt in the world. I'm not Black, I'm Asian, but you know, still sort of this kind of the idea of like white feminism didn't fit. And I think a lot that I've learned from the Black radical tradition and Black feminist thought, Hill Collins, Patricia Hill Collins among others, is that, you know, you have to look at those who are the most dispossessed, and not that that happens on a unidimensional scale or that it's Black white, but if, so, you know, so to this question of like, how do we know when we're make, when something's making a difference, how do we know when progress is working? Well, you ask the people who need, who were supposed to be. I mean, it sounds, again, so basic, but I think to Simone's point, a lot of times that's not where we're looking for solutions. We go to some, you know, heady experts that are not from the community, that may not have a good sense of whether or not these things work and that if it's what they want. So, you know, again, I think just sort of thinking about the people who are the most affected, the most dispossessed, and is like a very basic democratic principle that we can use to measure progress.
Do you want to add, or should I move on?
We can move on to the next one.
Okay, cool. I wasn't sure whether you were hitting the unmute button, because sometimes that happens.
Well, you know, actually, I should jump in with a few thoughts on this. Yeah, so I'm not totally pessimistic. You know, thinking about, you know, what does seem to be, you know, places where we're moving forward, and, you know, things are looking optimistic. One that I mentioned before, you know, is that, you know, the individual now in charge of the trust relationship between Native nations and the United States is an Indigenous woman, Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland. I think, you know, though it's maybe not as, you know, earth-shatteringly transformative as we would hope and would like to see, you know, I still think it represents an important shift, right, to have an Indigenous woman on Biden's cabinet. And I certainly think that represents, you know, moving in a positive direction. And I would note, too, that I think, you know, as a way to explain that, I think it's important to acknowledge that this is not something that passively was gifted to Indian country by Joe Biden, that he gave us a Secretary of the Interior. That's to say that Indigenous political organizing and institutions in the United States, you know, have become increasingly successful. So that's to say that an Indian country campaigned for Deb Haaland. If anything, Deb Haaland becoming Secretary of the Interior is now evidence, right, of just how powerful a native political voice can be in U.S. politics, right? That if Indian countries' leaders push hard enough, we can influence even the composition of the cabinet itself. Maybe not every time, right? This is a really special opportunity with Deb Haaland. But still, that represents an important positive shift. One other quick thing I'll note is, I mentioned this case earlier, 2005, City of Sherrill, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and doubling down on the doctrine of discovery. We can see in the last 15 years, a small but definitely a noticeable shift. The most important Supreme Court case in federal Indian law in the last few years was McGirt v. Oklahoma, which was decided last summer. And in that case, which is about questions of, were the boundaries of the Creek Nation's territory in Oklahoma dissolved or modified? They weren't. It's a simple matter of they just weren't. The work that I do on Oneida Nation is about processes of buying back land on parallel questions, right? So I should note in terms of progress, by the way, that the stuff that I'm writing about is, even buying back our own land, right, comes to face its obstacles, right? It's not so easy for us to just buy back our own territory and put it back into trust. That itself opens up new problems, right? So it's not just a simple matter of progress. But in this case, the question is, were the boundaries of the reservation ever dissolved in any way? Well, they were created by treaty. End of story, right? Nothing else happened, right? And so the real question is, the argument that came out of the Supreme Court, right, from some at least, it wasn't the majority opinion, but the Brett Kavanaugh opinion was, yeah, but white people have been living in this part of Oklahoma for a century now and governing it. Doesn't it no longer exist as indigenous sovereign land? And the Supreme Court emphatically just says, no, that's not how that works, right? This case, decided last summer, is one that experts in this world have described as one of the most important cases in the last half century. And it's emphatic in its simplicity. It really, really is, because it is the least earth-shattering consequential case ever. Because all that Gorsuch says in his majority opinion is, absent of any congressional action to have changed these boundaries of the Creek Nation's territory, we don't see any reason to change them, right? So we hold Congress to its word on past agreement, as in, the big earth-shattering conclusion is, we made an agreement by treaty, which was, ratified by Congress, and we'll stick to that. Simple concept, and that simple concept, I think, is also, in terms of, core. Back to obstacles of justice again, but also sources of reform. The U.S. maintains, within U.S. federal law, what it calls plenary power over Indian affairs. That is to say that the United States Congress, if it so wishes, can get rid of a treaty with Native people at will. This is the sort of thing that happened in the 1950s already. Tribal communities outright terminated, right? The Menominee Nation of Wisconsin overnight became Menominee County, Wisconsin. It's since been restored, but many communities that were terminated were not restored, right? So Congress maintains this ultimate superpower, right? It may do whatever it wishes in regards to indigenous affairs, right? So that's not really sovereignty at all then on the indigenous side of things, right? And so I think that's, getting past the plenary power that Congress holds over indigenous nations. That's one, important step.
Strikes me as a really central sort of challenge, right? Is the ability to affect real change requires some form of power. But the power structure itself is, of course, part of why we have the challenge in the first place, and that goes to the categories we use, to the measures we use, to the political institutions we have, and I think that's a really important insight. I like to end my sessions, and we're 1 minute from the hour with a very sort of quick reaction, simple question for a quick answer. Are there any just inequalities? Or put it other ways, are there any inequalities that we would be okay with?
My very quick response to that is, I'm sure there are, but it's so hard to figure out that because you would need so much information to determine that it's just. Like, I'm personally comfortable with, I think there can be just inequality, I do. I just, the struggle would be to really determine that it is just because there's so many hidden mechanisms of inequality that could be kind of underlying things.
Right. But, and that's exactly what our conversation has sort of shown, that there's so many layers that you'd have to take into account, and you can't just make a quick judgment, right?
And rather than attempt an answer at that, I'll just co-sign Simone.
Good.
I think it depends on how you conceive of inequality. And obviously this is a longer conversation, but I think that people conceive of that really differently, right? So difference itself is not necessarily inequality. But maybe this is for another hour conversation.
That's perfect. Yeah, I mean, so sorry for the curveball. I mean, I threw it in because this is also our opening panel for the quarter, and you know, we'll have many more sessions that look at many of the details. But I think it is one of the overarching, you know, sort of topics that we want to tackle. And so I just wanted to bring in the question, not to put you on the spot. let me really thank you, all three of you, for a wonderful conversation and a very open and informative and insightful conversation, exactly the type that we like to foster for the for those webinars. For the audience members, you can expect to receive a survey, and we hope you fill it in and share your feedback. We also encourage you to subscribe to our mailing list. And join for future webinars and other Buffett activities. Our next webinar will be on April 20th, and it will feature Amara Enya, the Managing Director of Diaspora Rising, a transnational media and advocacy hub that works to strengthen bonds among global Black family. And then we will have bi-weekly, every other week, webinars all the way until the end of the quarter. So I hope you'll be back and join us for many more wonderful conversations. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.